Books on Tape presents Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow, read by Scott Brick. Observations by Alexander Hamilton. I have thought it my duty to exhibit things as they are, not as they ought to be. Letter of August 13th, 1782. The passions of a revolution are apt to hurry even good men into excesses. Essay of August 12th, 1795. Men are rather reasoning than reasonable animals, for the most part governed by the impulse of passion. Letter of April 16th, 1802. Opinion, whether well or ill-founded, is the governing principle of human affairs. Letter of June 18th, 1778. Prologue. The Oldest Revolutionary War Widow. In the early 1850s, few pedestrians strolling past the house on H Street in Washington, near the White House, realized that the ancient widow seated by the window, knitting and arranging flowers, was the last surviving link to the glory days of the early Republic. 50 years earlier, on a rocky, secluded ledge overlooking the Hudson River in Weehawken, New Jersey, Aaron Burr, the Vice President of the United States, had fired a mortal shot at her husband, Alexander Hamilton, in a misbegotten effort to remove the man Burr regarded as the main impediment to the advancement of his career. Hamilton was then 49 years old. Was it a benign or a cruel destiny that had compelled the widow to outlive her husband by half a century, struggling to raise 7 children and surviving almost until the eve of the Civil War? Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, purblind and deaf but gallant to the end, was a stoic woman who never yielded to self-pity. With her gentle manner, Dutch tenacity, and quiet humor, she clung to the deeply rooted religious beliefs that had abetted her reconciliation to the extraordinary misfortunes she had endured. Even in her early 90s, she still dropped to her knees for family prayers. Wrapped in shawls and garbed in the black bombazine dresses that were de rigueur for widows, she wore a starched white ruff and frilly white cap that bespoke a simpler era in American life. The dark eyes that gleamed behind large metal-rimmed glasses, those same dark eyes that had once enchanted a young officer on General George Washington's staff, betokened a sharp intelligence, a fiercely indomitable spirit, and a memory that refused to surrender the past. In the front parlor of the house she now shared with her daughter, Eliza Hamilton had crammed the faded memorabilia of her now distant marriage. When visitors called, the tiny, erect, white-haired lady would grab her cane, rise gamely from a black sofa embroidered with a floral pattern of her own design, and escort them to a Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington. She motioned with pride to a silver wine cooler tucked discreetly beneath the center table that had been given to the Hamiltons by Washington himself. This treasured gift retained a secret meaning for Eliza, for it had been a tacit gesture of solidarity from Washington when her husband was ensnared in the first major sex scandal in American history. The tour's highlight stood enshrined in the corner, a marble bust of her dead hero, carved by an Italian sculptor, Giuseppe Ciaracchi, during Hamilton's heyday as the first Treasury Secretary. Portrayed in the classical style of a noble Roman senator, a toga draped across one shoulder, Hamilton exuded a brisk energy and a massive intelligence in his wide brow, his face illumined by the half-smile that often played about his features. This was how Eliza wished to recall him, ardent, hopeful, and eternally young. "That bust I can never forget," one young visitor remembered, "for the old lady always paused before it in her tour of the rooms and, leaning on her cane, gazed and gazed as if she could never be satisfied." For the select few, Eliza unearthed documents written by Hamilton that qualified as her sacred scripture. An early hymn he had composed or a letter he had drafted during his impoverished boyhood on St. Croix. She frequently grew melancholy and longed for a reunion with her Hamilton, as she invariably referred to him. "One night, I remember, she seemed sad and absent-minded and could not go to the parlor where there were visitors, but sat near the fire and played backgammon for a while," said one caller. "When the game was done, she leaned back in her chair a long time with closed eyes, as if lost to all around her." There was a long silence, broken by the murmured words, "I am so tired. It is so long. I want to see Hamilton." Eliza Hamilton was committed to one holy quest above all others, to rescue her husband's historical reputation from the gross slanders that had tarnished it. For many years after the duel, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and other political enemies had taken full advantage of their eloquence and longevity to spread defamatory anecdotes about Hamilton, who had been condemned to everlasting silence. Determined to preserve her husband's legacy, Eliza enlisted as many as 30 assistants to sift through his tall stacks of papers. Unfortunately, she was so self-effacing and so reverential toward her husband that though she salvaged every scrap of his writing, she apparently destroyed her own letters. The capstone of her monumental labor, her life's dearest object, was the publication of a mammoth authorized biography that would secure Hamilton's niche in the pantheon of the early republic. It was a long, exasperating wait as one biographer after another discarded the project or expired before its completion. Almost by default, the giant enterprise fell to her fourth son, John Church Hamilton, who belatedly disgorged a 7-volume history of his father's exploits. Before this hagiographic tribute was completed, however, Eliza Hamilton died at 97 on November 9th, 1854. Distraught that their mother had waited vainly for decades to see her husband's life immortalized, Eliza Hamilton Holly scolded her brother for his overdue biography. "Lately in my hours of sadness, recurring to such interests as most deeply affected our blessed mother, I could recall none more frequent or more absorbent than her devotion to our father. When blessed memory shows her gentle countenance and her untiring spirit before me, in this one great and beautiful aspiration after duty, I feel the same spark ignite and bid me to seek the fulfillment of her words, 'Justice shall be done to the memory of my Hamilton.'" It was, Eliza Hamilton Holly noted pointedly, the imperative duty that Eliza had bequeathed to all her children. "Justice shall be done to the memory of my Hamilton." Well, has justice been done? Few figures in American history have aroused such visceral love or loathing as Alexander Hamilton. To this day, he seems trapped in a crude historical cartoon that pits Jeffersonian democracy against Hamiltonian aristocracy. For Jefferson and his followers, wedded to their vision of an agrarian Eden, Hamilton was the American Mephistopheles, the proponent of such devilish contrivances as banks, factories, and stock exchanges. They demonized him as a slavish pawn of the British crown, a closet monarchist, a Machiavellian intriguer, a would-be Caesar. Noah Webster contended that Hamilton's ambition, pride, and overbearing temper had destined him to be the evil genius of this country. Hamilton's powerful vision of American nationalism, with states subordinate to a strong central government and led by a vigorous executive branch, aroused fears of a reversion to royal British ways. His seeming solicitude for the rich caused critics to portray him as a snobbish tool of plutocrats who was contemptuous of the masses. For another group of naysayers, Hamilton's unswerving faith in a professional military converted him into a potential despot. "From the first to the last words he wrote," concluded historian Henry Adams, "I read always the same Napoleonic kind of adventuredom." Even some Hamilton admirers have been unsettled by a faint tincture of something foreign in this West Indian transplant. Woodrow Wilson grudgingly praised Hamilton as a very great man, but not a great American. Yet many distinguished commentators have echoed Eliza Hamilton's lament that justice has not been done to her Hamilton. He has tended to lack the glittering multi-volume biographies that have burnished the fame of other founders. The British statesman Lord Bryce singled out Hamilton as the one founding father who had not received his due from posterity. In the American Commonwealth, he observed, "One cannot note the disappearance of this brilliant figure, to Europeans the most interesting in the early history of the Republic, without the remark that his countrymen seem to have never, either in his lifetime or afterwards, duly recognized his splendid gifts." During the robust era of progressive republicanism, marked by brawny nationalism and energetic government, Theodore Roosevelt took up the cudgels and declared Hamilton the most brilliant American statesman who ever lived, possessing the loftiest and keenest intellect of his time. His White House successor, William Howard Taft, likewise embraced Hamilton as our greatest constructive statesman.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?